From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. It's a gorgeous day out there. It's like in between summer and fall, so beautiful and sunny, and I think tonight we will be able to see the moonrise and the sunset at the same time, which is kind of cool. So have a look for that. Today on Write the Book, we have Ralph Culver, whose wonderful new collection of poems is A Passable Man, just out from Mad Hat Press, whose poetry, fiction, and criticism have appeared in many publications and several anthologies. He is a past grantee in poetry of the Vermont Arts Council. His poetry collection, Both Distances, won the 2012 Anabiosis Press Chapbook Prize and was followed in 2018 by So Be It. A Passable Man is his first full-length collection. Ralph was born in Illinois and raised in Pittsburgh. He has lived in Vermont for many years. He studied writing and literature at Goddard College, the New School, and the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College. He also studied filmmaking at UVM. When I spoke with Ralph, I began by asking him to read the poem Tableau from his new collection. Our conversation continues from there. I hope you enjoy it.
Tableau. A boy lies on his stomach on the floor, head propped up on his left hand, drawing in a sketchbook with his right. So far, only a line or two. Just a suggestion of a shape. Over near the window, sitting at his desk, a man stares at a sheet of paper rolled into a typewriter. A few words are there, nothing substantial. And the third figure in the room, whose very form is nascent, untroubled by detail, nearly transparent, really. Although the man and the boy sense a presence, acknowledge it, they pay it no mind. Confident as they are, as you are reading this, as I am writing it, that now is not the time the figure congeals, casting a shadow at last, and rises to take his measure.
Great. I really enjoyed that. I love the fact that the drawing at the beginning of the poem mirrors the unfinished nature of his trajectory. Uh-huh. You know, just a suggestion of a shape. That's kind of fun. So what was the inspiration for this one? Did you just sort of have a moment and go like, oh, that's kind of cool?
You know, the inspiration for this poem was actually something very specific. There's a room in the last house that I was growing up in that I shared with my parents. And my there was a room that we called the den that was also had a desk with a typewriter on it that my parents both used. And when I originally started writing the poem, I had this image in my mind of my father sitting at the desk at the typewriter, and I was the boy lying on the floor with a sketch pad. And as I worked, in fact, in the earlier versions of this, the man sitting at the desk came first before the boy. And then I reversed that order, which seemed much more logical to me because the boy's on the floor. And so there's also, I hope, a sense of the boy kind of being able to look up and see the man sitting at the desk. And then I had an understanding that this was really about time in a way and aging, that the boy on the floor with the sketch pad could very well be, perhaps is, the man sitting, you know, later in his life, sitting at the desk with a typewriter. And then that, of course, leads into the third section, which, I mean, I would hope doesn't take a lot of explication or like specific detail to describe, but
no, I think analyzing the third part ruins the third part.
I think you're right. so we won't spend any time doing that.
No, I enjoyed it though. It was really good.
I'm glad you liked it.
Now, did you draw when you were a kid?
Oh, a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. In fact, one of my, one of the things I wanted to be from a very young age was a comic strip artist. I loved Walt Kelly and Charles Schulz and, you know, Pogo and Peanuts and Al Capp's Lil Abner. I mean, I loved drawing, and I made comic books as a kid, just taking, you know, a sheaf of typewriter paper, folding it in half, stapling it down one side, and then turning those pages into comics. It was really fun.
Yeah. I will say one thing about the third section, and that is the word untroubled. The third figure in the room is untroubled by detail, and I really liked that. I think that in our lives and as we age too, detail, and particularly for writers, getting words just right and being able to express things as best we can, and that's so important to us, isn't it? And then ultimately, they're, you know, all of our words are just describing concepts that aren't that important, perhaps, once you're not a writer, once you're not, you know.
Right.
Anyway, so that was kind of cool, too. Okay, well, so let's look at another poem. I wonder if you'd mind reading the one called The Misunderstanding.
Of course. The Misunderstanding. I did not say, "You are nothing to me." I said the hummingbird, the anglerfish, are not amazed at themselves. I did not say, "I have forgotten you," but that every day a man finds more things that trouble him. Not, "You are not beautiful," but that often when I lie in the grass, a lute sings in the earth beneath me. Not, "I regret," but that I stare at these keys I carry in my pocket and think of the narrow bones I once turned over in the garden. Not, "I never loved you," but "You are all you have." As for the rest, yes, it is as you say, the words are mine. But all the rooms of the world we have lived in close now over the words of others. Earth, keys, man, when will you seek out that lamp, that light under which they were written?
Wonderful. Thank you. I love the refrain of it. And the refrain, and it's interesting because you don't stick specifically with the refrain, which is, "I did not say." You eventually shorten it and let the reader remember it on their own by moving into "not," you know, which is the sort of like summary of "I did not say." So what's the value of a refrain in poetry or prose? What do you think a reader enjoys about a refrain?
Well, probably the first thing it does is it establishes a tempo. It's almost a rhythmic thing, even more necessarily than a linguistic thing. And the other thing that it does, and the two, I guess, sort of go hand in hand, is it sort of shines a spotlight on whatever whatever those words are, whatever the refrain consists of. The writer must feel that it has some import. It has some, you know, that it has some significance. Mm-hmm. And refrains in poetry, I think, just as in song, is a way of sort of hooking the listener and maybe, you know, not quite as importantly, but it's a way of getting the reader or the listener to pay attention.
Yeah. I felt a certain tension between the speaker and the listener, and it's clearly a very specific conversation between two people. The reader is just a voyeur in this poem, that was interesting too. It tells a story, and it's a story that we don't get the whole backstory on, but we have a sense of it. We have a sense of what's happening in this relationship and where the two parties sort of are in their minds and what they're processing, each of them.
Yeah.
You don't want to give too much information about the story. It's a poem, and it's a larger poem than the story itself. But it's nice to give a little context, and I felt like you did that really well.
Oh, thank you. If someone were to ask me what the poem is about, I mean, rather than getting into specific detail, it just strikes me, I mean, throughout our entire lives, when we're young, when we're older, in relationship. I mean, it's just so important that we feel seen and heard by our partner. That's sort of the kernel of this poem.
Mm-hmm. Great. The next one that I was going to ask you to read is Sundown Coming, and the Hummingbird is Called Home.
Sure. Sundown Coming, and the Hummingbird is Called Home. Two sections, conveniently numbered 1 and 2. 1. How suddenly the air has cooled. Rain gives thanks and joins its forebears, plunging drop by silver drop into the trout pond. As the sky clears, stars begin to follow in the paths of the rain. 2. Somewhere, molded from leaf bits and bound around with caterpillar web and the beard silk of tall grasses, a cup the size of a vole's bedroll trembles in the fork of a slender bough, cradles 2 eggs. They glint like lost beads of a child's bracelet. Embers from the fire spark downward, stutter and whisper to the attentive earth by where these boots stand, drying.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
So you mentioned the two parts and they are numbered. So when you're writing a poem, when do you know that you're going to be writing in a couple of different parts or even more than two parts?
That's a very good question. And I guess, I mean, the stock answer, but just because it's a stock answer doesn't mean it has no validity, is, you know, the saying form follows function. I would say that dividing a poem into sections is sort of an example of that. You know, why are novels divided into chapters? I mean, a section of a thing is obviously in some sense sort of self-contained, but at the same time, if it's the first section, it's leading you into whatever is, you know, to come after. If it's the last section, it should be led into, and is, you know, and I mean, in that same kind of way, so that it draws you to a conclusion. And, you know, usually the sections in poems can represent a lot of different things. They can represent perhaps a slight change maybe in perspective, either from the voice another section can represent an entirely different voice. They can represent a change in scenery, sort of.
Mm-hmm. To me, in this one, it represented almost a change in tone a little bit. The first part seems more, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be like zooming in on a certain thing. It's looking at everything. In fact, it really struck me as very sort of Native American in the language and in the gratitude for the natural world.
Right.
The second part feels more like we are literally looking in on that nest or that, I don't know what it is. Is it a nest?
Yeah, a hummingbird nest. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen one. They are fascinating.
No.
The birds are so small. I mean, they're just tiny creatures. And of course, the eggs that they lay are minuscule. I mean, they're very beautiful, though. A hummingbird nest is a very beautiful thing, both in its sort of appearance and the way that they're made.
Yeah. I only recently saw hummingbirds up close for the first time. Literally, like in the last 2 years is the first time I've ever seen them up close. And it's just like, wow, they're really tiny.
They are tiny, and they are so cool. They are very, very cool creatures.
Yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you about this poem is these boots. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because that also refocuses our attention to these boots. It was an interesting change to me. I wasn't expecting it.
Right. Well, suddenly there's sort of this human intrusion, right? You know, I mean, and what you, I suppose, in a sense, I don't know if you would call it a classic nature poem, but you'd call it a nature poem, right? And like you were talking about the first section, which in a way is almost strictly observational. I mean, it's just, it's a sort of a scene setting. And you mentioned Native American, which I mean, I'm delighted that it brings that association up with you. I also sort of think of, I read a lot of and have studied a lot of Eastern poetry, haiku and haibun and that sort of thing. And that first section to me sort of has some of that kind of sense of it. But yeah, the boots standing there drying, I think, came in really late, actually, in the writing of the poem. And I just thought, oh, you know, it'd be sort of interesting to at least suddenly give kind of a hint of maybe, you know, the observer of this phenomenon that's being described, you know, like maybe, I don't know, I thought of like somebody tent camping or something like that, you know. The boots are wet and the fire is going, and suddenly there's a fire, which comes sort of from out of nowhere, and then there are boots next to the fire, and they're drying out. So.
Sometimes I just have these reactions to poems, which I think is kind of the lovely beauty of poems. But to me, the boots also added to the scale that you're looking at between the little creature and the observer, because boots are worn by giants a lot of times. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So yeah. I enjoyed that perspective. I didn't necessarily think the poet had that in mind, but
no, that's great. That's lovely.
Let's read Fishing with My Father and the Craft of Poetry.
Okay.
Or let's have you read it, actually.
I will be happy to. Fishing with My Father and the Craft of Poetry. Hours holding the poles over the water. Hours of catching nothing or not much and throwing back what we did catch. What the hell was that about anyway? And yet today I have this patience for things that drive some people crazy, standing in line at the supermarket, waiting for some fool blowhard to stop gabbing, searching for a coat button in the snow. The finely honed conviction that beneath this nothing is a deeper, richer nothing. Consecrating myself to the silence and then to what interrupts the silence.
Thank you. Now, this, I should say, is one of three poems for your father in the third section of this collection. Mm-hmm. And he's in this poem, but he's not mentioned. He's not, other than in the title, but right. The poles are plural, and there's definitely a companionship there. And you know, it's wonderful because it's about fishing and it's about writing, but it's also about being here without your father now. You know, you're consecrated to the silence and then to what interrupts the silence. I mean, to me, that's also about your father being here, not being here, perhaps.
Yes. As a poem, I think it seems fairly straightforward. I don't think there's not too much mystery around it. But I appreciate very much your feeling that I think you describe it as he kind of appears or maybe makes an appearance toward the end of the poem. I'm grateful that you felt that in there. And I don't know, in some way, those lines, consecrating myself to the silence and then to what interrupts the silence, is a representation, not just of writing or of creating, but of actually sort of living itself.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. I wanted to ask you a couple things that don't have specifically to do with any poems. What ties these poems together as a collection? And what was your preoccupation maybe in the years that you were writing these? That the collection is A Passable Man. Well, you know, how would you describe the link that brings these together and makes them all deserve to be standing next to each other?
I guess the first point that I would make in answering that is that the poems, in terms of their writing, cover an enormous span of ground. Some of them are, a couple anyway, are as recent as just having been written in the last year or two. The oldest poem in the collection probably actually goes back to when I was in high school. I probably started writing it when I was in high school. So it covers an enormous amount of territory just in terms of time. And one of the things that I wanted to do with the book, and the reason why it was sectioned in the way that it was because I felt that there was, in most cases, sort of a really clear and distinct energy with certain poems that kind of magnetize, you know, that kind of cause them to come together. And like the first section of the book, for example, is primarily focused on events of youth, childhood and youth, for example. And then as the book goes on, the second section, and then especially the third section, I would think is more, you know, a kind of adolescent, post-adolescent, 20s, 30s, you know, type of energy, which is not necessarily pleasant. And then in a sense, Shayla, the book really is about relationship and relationships. Beyond those first three sections, the last couple of sections of the book, I hope kind of balance out the first half of the book by including poems that are sort of a more general, you know, topical nature, as opposed to some. There are a lot of in the second half of the book. I've written a number of poems about people, you know, people I've known, some in some cases well, in some cases not so well, but I was really sort of taken by the work that they did. So there's the one in the plant shop, there's one called Seamstress, there's one called Glassblower. I mean, these are poems about specific people I have known whose work was, you know, one was worked with plants, one was a seamstress, one was an artist who blew glass. And those poems, I hope, those kinds of poems, certainly not the whole rest of the book consists of those, but I kind of hope that some of that balances out the more angsty, you know, perhaps troublesome or troubling.
I didn't find the beginning of the book troubling. I found you know, I mean, I feel like it's very honest to work out some of the issues of our past, to think about. And in fact, I do feel like there's a little bit of a release in the last section of the book. I don't know if it's that the subject matter has changed so much as that the tone is a lot more, at peace, maybe, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah.
I would agree with, yeah.
Let's see. I do always like to ask if my guests have read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. And, you know, in your case, it can be poetry, it can be fiction, nonfiction, whatever.
Sidney Lee, who is an emeritus poet laureate of our beautiful state of Vermont.
He's an emeritus on this show, too. He's been here a lot.
His latest book is called Here, and it is really wonderful. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it or talk to Sidney about it, but it's a wonderful book. I've been, and this is actually sort of my second time through it. So that's one sort of contemporary that I would recommend. I've also been reading a lot of Li Bai, who is a great Chinese poet he predates Shakespeare by centuries, which sort of goes hand in hand in a way with my just overall interest and fascination in Eastern poetry, the Japanese and the Chinese. And I've been writing, and I don't know, I mean, I guess this is probably true of a lot of people, but I also noticed that the more deeply I sort of get into a poet or a particular type of poet or a particular kind of poetry, that begins to kind of affect what I'm doing as well. So those are
great.
Two things that I've been looking at.
Okay. Wonderful. Ralph, why don't we finish up with your reading First Night, Perkins Pier, which I loved that it was a local poem and people can relate to First Night and also the place. So,
right. First Night, Perkins Pier. Here a woman draws a white coat close against the cold. The sky presents its chalice. Please dissolve in smoke at the lips of young children refusing to come in. Nothing will change. Each day plays the songs of water, of bread, of dying. Yet the winter lasts only a moment. Edging the lake ice, a girl tests her new skates, ringing a silver bell, eating a coin of chocolate.
Thank you very much. Wonderful. That's a wonderful place, I think, to leave it. Beautiful poem about Perkins Pier and First Night, which, of course, is our New Year's Eve celebration each year in Burlington, Vermont.
It's also one of the only, there are only three, there's a section of notes on the poems at the end of the book. And this is one of the three poems in those notes.
Oh, right, right. Yes. It's acrostic.
It's an acrostic. Right, right. Which your listeners are not going to be able to see because they don't have the poem to look at on the page. But it spells Happy New Year down the left-hand margin.
That's right. I meant to mention that. Right. Because the first word of each line, so the first words are here, against, presents, please, young, nothing, each, water, yet edging, a, ringing. So lovely. And I thought that was great because, you know, a lot of times with an acrostic poem, you can kind of see that they're wedging things in there, you know, trying to get to that. And yours was just, obviously, I completely forgot it was acrostic when I was finishing up here. All right. I want to mention again, the name of the collection is A Passable Man by my guest from today, Ralph Culver, and published by Mad Hat Press, coming out in September 2021. Thank you, Ralph.
Jayla, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ralph Culver about his new book, A Passable Man, published by Mad Hat Press. You can learn more about Ralph's work on his poets and writers listing and his publisher's website, madhat-press.com. Okay, if you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know, please, that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, news about book-related events, then I can announce them in the Bookworm's calendar like I just did. Do send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And of course, if you like the show, please rate it where you find it. Like it on Facebook, tweet about it, tell your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week. Take care.